You're listening to Inspired by Interfaith Voices. We've been talking about how both the religiously affiliated and unaffiliated are finding meaning within the sacred pregnancy movement. Samira Mehta is director of the Jewish Studies program at the University of Colorado in Boulder. She is working on a book about the religious battle over abortion. Host Umbreen Khan talked with Dr. Mehta about the very specific words rooted in religion that are chosen by both sides in the culture wars to describe women, pregnancy, and infants.
Samira Mehta, thank you so much for joining me on Inspired by Interfaith Voices.
Thank you so much for having me.
Samira, tell listeners a little bit about what your area of interest is in this fantastic big universe known as the Academy.
Sure. So I am an associate professor of women and gender studies and Jewish studies at the University of Colorado Boulder. I'm also just completing a year as a research associate in the Women's Studies and Religion program at Harvard Divinity School. So I have been spending this year at Harvard writing a book called God Bless the Pill, which is a history of contraception, of religious involvements in battles over contraception from about World War II to about the Reagan administration.
As you've been studying and looking at the evolution of policy that's regulating women's contraception and impacting women's abilities to make choices about whether or not to attempt to become mothers, where and how has the language shifted in the conversation?
You see a shift in the sort of early history of what we now know as Planned Parenthood. They were originally the Birth Control League of America. And there was this fear that the phrase birth control league, like, why do you need birth control? You need birth control so that you can have consequence-free sex, right? Whereas Planned Parenthood, you are thoughtfully planning when and how to bring children into the world so that you can make sure that you can appropriately care for them. So there's this idea also that not that birth control will result in the ability to get married and then go to law school without getting knocked up, but rather the ability to live off of your husband's good union job without side income, freeing you to be home during doing that kind of really intensive and in the sort of 1950s better living through chemistry model of life, scientifically informed parenting.
In the history of the battle over women's reproductive rights, there have been religiously motivated actors throughout that are very mindful of rhetoric to advance not just their policy arguments, but to build public favor. And I'm thinking about the adoption of terms like the quote unquote gift of life, which invokes the idea of a creator and that the marital actions have a purpose. Words like ensoulment, which was used to describe a moment that science, we should say, cannot prove. And then, of course, the term sanctity. Tell me a little bit about some of the words I just used. What stands out about how they were employed and why?
So I think what's really interesting is the language gets mobilized in both directions. So in Griswold versus Connecticut, which is the 1965 Supreme Court decision that gives married couples the right to birth control, the sort of text of the decision refers to the marriage relationship as older than the Bill of Rights, older than our political parties, older than our school system. Marriage is a coming together, for better or for worse, hopefully enduring, and intimate to the degree of being sacred. It is an association that promotes a way of life, not causes, harmony in living, not political faiths. A bilateral loyalty, not commercial or social projects. Yet it is an association for as noble a purpose as any involved in our prior decisions. So not only do they explicitly use the word sacred there to describe the marriage relationship, but they do so in some ways that set it against some other ideas. So first of all, there's this argument for the age of the institution of marriage and for the intimacy that makes marriage sacred. It's trying to create the idea that marriage, the like heterosexual marriage rooted in intimacy, which has obviously physical connotations in a conversation about birth control, but also emotional connotations in a society that is really valuing companionate marriage, marriage based in romantic love, as eternal. And in fact, like, we know that that's not actually the case. Think about the history of marriage. A robust history of marriage tells us that marriage has often, in different historical moments, not had all that much to do with love, not had all that much to do with privacy, not had all that much to do with consensual sex, and also actually had a lot to do with some of the things that they're saying, like it is sacred, it's not commercial. And so the word sacred there is giving marriage this eternal and very protected quality. It's saying that the marriage bed is a sacred place into which the courts must not peer. So in that case, the word sacred actually expands birth control rights. But when people talk about the sanctity of life, they're usually trying to restrict access to abortion.
I want to ask you about the word mother, the origin and values laden with the word mother. How do you see that word understood in our popular rhetoric and in our culture around these debates?
I think that mothers are seen as supremely valuable. But one thing that's really striking in almost all religious conversations about contraception from the middle of the 20th century is it talks about mothers and protecting mothers' health, the health of mothers, and their ability to mother. It doesn't talk about women. Early birth control activists, people like Margaret Sanger and Catherine McCormick, do think about women and their hopes and dreams. But the discourse that really takes over in that shift, basically, from the Birth Control League of America to the Planned Parenthood Federation of America, is a shift from thinking about women as sexual beings with sexual autonomy to thinking about mothers, people whose health must be protected because children do better when raised by mothers who are healthy and well than by mothers who are sick or mothers who are dead. You see motherhood held up as something that is a sacred calling and a vocation. And that is a reason why you might not need universal childcare. By making motherhood sacred, you make women who are not mothers lesser, failures as women, almost failures as human. Women without children are told that because they are not mothers, they cannot know real love, the purity of maternal love for her children, as if no mothers ever abuse their children. And also by holding mothers up as sacred in that way and ultimately selfless, you undercut any need to give them robust structural social support to do the work of motherhood. The sacred nature of motherhood undercuts women who are not mothers and women who are mothers. And it also serves a little bit, I think, to divide and conquer.
What do you mean by that?
Think about the mommy wars of women who stay home versus women who go back to work. But also think about when a woman is made to feel like she's less of a woman because she is not a mother. That makes it hard to make common cause with women who get all of the sort of cultural veneration that comes with being mothers, but no concrete social support. It shouldn't. And I think when we're at our best politically, it doesn't. But I think there are lots of examples throughout histories of feminist movements of battle lines fought on those grounds.
You study American religion and how American religious voices engage in bringing different ideas that are rooted in their traditions into the public conversation on deeply personal matters. What do you see happening today around the idea that you just articulated on the veneration of the person who is named mother?
I think we're seeing a lot of laws that, using both the sanctity of life argument and an implicit veneration of mothers, strip away women's reproductive agency. That's what you see in the overturning of Roe and in the Dobbs decision, which, if you look at the text of the Dobbs decision, you see historically inaccurate denigration of abortion throughout history. There's the idea that it has never been acceptable, when in fact, if you look at early 19th century newspapers, you can see ads. Right? So there's this sort of ahistorical, and that serves not only to strip away women's reproductive agency, but has also at times been marshaled. And I'm not sure that we're seeing this yet, but can and has been marshaled at times to undercut social supports that allow women economic agency. So, for instance, the Concerned Women for America, which was a Republican anti-equal rights amendment, the argument was really that women's equality was going to take away women's protection, right? That you would be forced into the workplace whether or not you wanted to go. And so what you can see there is that veneration of motherhood does not result automatically in social support for the role of motherhood.
Are you saying that the veneration of motherhood and the push to focus on the sanctity and sacredness of what it means to be a mother comes at a cost that we may not see in undercutting the supports necessary to support moms who have to work? Or moms who may not come from a two-income household, or moms who have different social supports and political supports and familial supports. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, and it's important to remember that that's very racialized in the United States. The kind of mothers who are most often able to stay home and be that kind of venerated mother are often white, and it automatically can create rhetoric in which women who cannot do those things, who are economically unable to do those things, women of color, single mothers, including widowed mothers, can end up being painted as bad mothers because they don't have the choices. They don't have access to the kinds of choices that society is venerating. It also assumes that women are fulfilling their role and purpose on earth by being mothers, and not, for instance, by having careers, particularly careers that are not sort of women's careers, right? Not careers that you can sort of neatly tuck into a school day.
As you observe the way words like sacred and ensoulment and sanctity of life are talked about in our culture, you see that connection to these other dynamics in play?
I think they're very much connected. I don't think they have to be. I think there have been moments in history when those words have appeared on either side of the argument. And the side that is using it is often looking to create a natural seeming version, the version of marriage, the version of family life that they are articulating. It gives it a literally God-given cast. And right now, that language tends to be used on the side of restricting rather than expanding access. But even when it's expanding access, it's often doing so at a particular cost.
How do you see movements like the spiritual doulas and movements of the spiritual but not religious generation of millennials, let's say, that are engaging in and adopting new rituals around becoming mothers that are not rooted in some of these religious political frames?
So I think that there can be immense meaning in those movements for individual people. I think that they often lack some of the political clout of the more structurally organized opposition. but that doesn't undercut the immense personal meaning that people can find.
Samira Mehta is director of the Jewish Studies Program at the University of Colorado in Boulder. She is currently a resident at Harvard Divinity School. That's all for this week's show. If you're interested in finding out more about our guests, head over to this episode's page on our website at interfaithradio.org. While you're there, you can also learn about us, read the show notes, sign up for our newsletter, and explore the archives. You can find our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or by searching Interfaith Voices in the podcatcher of your choice. This week's episode was produced by me, Kimberly Winston, Kevin McCarthy, and Umbreen Khan. Thanks to our founder, Maureen Fiedler, for her vision, and MC Yogi for our theme music. Additional music is by Blue Dot Sessions and Audio Binger. Inspired is a production of Interfaith Voices.